Hello, and welcome to the Utopia is a Scam podcast. Today I'm joined by a very special guest. Her name is Allison McDowell, and she is a mother, activist, and independent researcher of the highest caliber. I highly recommend her blog, wrenchingthegears.com, for a detailed look at the challenges we are facing as a species, from artificial intelligence, militarized financial technology, the rise of biocapitalism, and far beyond. Without further ado, Allison McDowell, it's great to be sharing this space with you.
Well, I'm very excited to be talking with you tonight. It's great.
It's an honor. Well, Allison, it is abundantly clear to me that we are not living in normal times. And wealth and power are being concentrated almost exponentially these days. Society seems to be on the brink of being transformed into something unrecognizable. And I think that more people are becoming aware of this as the threat externalizes itself. But for many, there remains an uncertainty about what exactly this threat is and how it operates. The powers that be speak of the fourth industrial revolution, where they expect our bodies and our minds to be integrated with an immersive digital reality, replete with biometric sensors, blockchain identity, and AI lurking around every corner. While this may sound outlandish to some, these are very real concepts being expanded upon and built by the most powerful high technology corporations in the world in cahoots with militarized hedge funds and the like. One of the primary components of how this system is being created and how it's being fueled is the realm of human capital finance and impact investment. These things pair emerging financial technologies driven by artificial intelligence and predictive data analytics with the age-old malignant principles behind colonization, eugenics, and exploitive poverty management systems. It is an expansion of many of the atrocities committed throughout human history, and I believe that it is vital to understand that perspective if we're going to persevere through this together and understand what's going on. That being said, would you like to help me expand on the world of human capital finance a bit?
Wow. You said that really well.
Thank you.
I mean, I have to say it's been, the past, I guess, going on almost a year now since the pandemic, it's been, it's really wonderful to hear other people articulate it that way, because for a while it felt really lonely about trying to talk about this stuff that nobody knew about. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that introduction. So just by way of background, I'm based in Philadelphia, and I came to this through really just being a parent navigating an underfunded school district in the city of Philadelphia. We're one of the largest cities and, you know, a predominantly Black city and a very poor city. And so we're also home to a lot of education institutions, including Wharton Business School, which is part of the University of Pennsylvania system. And so a lot of these innovative financial techniques and techniques of essentially sort of behaviorism and the psychological manipulation were coming out of the University of Pennsylvania system and on through the Rockefeller Foundation, when our former president, Judith Rodin, went on, when she left Penn, she became head of the Rockefeller Foundation, and they set a lot of the infrastructure up for these financial deals. So I sort of live in the space. Initially my world was very focused around, a different kind of data, a small nibble corner, and people come to this from a lot of different ways, because this element of turning life and social relations into data and data analytics really affects every aspect of life. So some people come into the space through issues around healthcare, concerns around healthcare issues. Some people come into the space around issues of food or housing insecurity, right? Some people are coming into the space from issues of like behavioral health or addiction. And so all of the elements in which we would, we have, social needs and, needs of personal care and shelter that would be tied in with the overall state matrix is in the process of being privatized. And my entry point was then in through the education system. And the data analytics that I started out with in a very small way were high stakes test scores, so reducing children and reducing their learning into these metrics that were then used to create markets for software technologies in the schools tied to sort of you know, ed reform practices and punishment of schools for not achieving their data metrics, but beyond that, to essentially start to profile children as data. So that's sort of how I came into it. Like, what would be helpful, like the first thing to say? Do you want me to talk about pay for success, or?
I think pay for success is like a good real world example to kind of help people and help myself, honestly, relate to what's going on and then how it's being advanced too, because it can seem like it snowballs really fast into like a science fiction dystopia, but then with what you lay out with like pay for success and stuff, it kind of just paves the way. And it's like, if people are investing in this like pay for success finance programs, and they're also developing all these other financial technologies and ways of other impact investment, then they mean business, you know? So I think that's a good place to start.
Well, so a lot of it too goes back, like this idea of engineering people and engineering individual behavior, engineering social behavior, back to sort of the technocracy movement of the, you know, late 19th, early 20th century, the 1930s, and then the 1970s around technocracy. And so we now, as we've gotten more and more sophisticated tools of surveillance and managing behaviors through digital mechanisms, it's become even more intense. So I often recommend, if people haven't seen the film or haven't seen it in a while, The Big Short, because what it does, the last global financial meltdown around the housing market, so, you know, over 10 years ago, really set the stage for what's coming, because many people never recovered from those losses, from lost homes, from lost economic security, lost jobs. There's, you know, the shift in the past 12 years has been towards gig economy employment, people losing access to any sort of stable employment and benefits. That's really manifested after that last crash. And so that level of destabilization has set people up for a different relationship to needing public assistance, right? Needing housing assistance, needing food assistance, needing job retraining, as well as the mental health impacts of trying to navigate these neoliberal systems. So The Big Short talks, essentially, it's really good at breaking down the idea of how these most powerful hedge funds, which, you know, hedge funds are different than venture capital firms, because at least on the one hand, venture capital firms, like there's this idea that they're investing in a business, you know, they're investing in a thing, where really hedge funds, it's just legalized gambling, right? And making new instruments to gamble on. And so these markets are driven by the hedge funds. So it really is about creating new legalized games of gambling. And in the last time out, it was on mortgages and the housing market. And they would bundle the mortgages together in tranches, and then those they would gamble on those mortgages. And then eventually, the people who realized that the housing market was going to crash, they made lots of money because they shorted these bonds. And so the movie sort of lays that out. But I think we can generally understand the idea of, like, you have a tangible asset that's someone's home, right? They're a child's home, and then it has debt attached to it. And then you take that debt, not only of that house, but of 1,000 other houses. And that debt is rated in terms of its quality, and it's packaged as an item, and then it's traded on a global market. So in that basic sense, the next thing that will be bundled and packaged as debt will be the ways in which people of the earth, global reset, this is tied to the fourth industrial revolution, will be profiled as burdens on society, burdens on the public coffer. How much do we expect you will need to lean on getting food, getting housing, getting training? Some people will have more assets than others due to intergenerational poverty. You know, they factor in things like your zip code, your parents' educational attainment. You know, my concern is increasingly it's going to even include genomic information. And then they will place sort of bets on you as, like even in utero, unborn children, not as sort of sacred beings of amazing potential, but like, how much is this kid gonna cost society, right? And then that number will be reframed as debt. And then that debt will essentially not be, it will be debt because the public, the government does not have the money to cover these needs. I mean, right, like the poor have very little income to pay on taxes. And then the most elite, the highest, the largest wealth holders, the hoarders of wealth, like the Amazons, they pay very little in tax, if anything, because they've got it all structured that they're not paying tax. So the government cannot meet the needs of the people, especially people who are going to be displaced by robotics and automation. And so they will, the plan is to use these innovative financial tools called pay for success to create investment markets in human capital. And that's what they call that. So they will be able to invest in people as a debt product, and that you will be sort of put on a pathway of self-improvement according to various social services, how you manage your, you know, training, how you manage your health and wellness, how you, you know, manage your good behavior, you know, within the judicial system. And then they will bet on you. And some people will bet that you attain your goals that are laid out for you, and some will bet that you don't. But you will have very little autonomy in that situation. And that within this, it's almost like a game, and that people will not have, they will be doing this in essentially is like a police state of a panopticon that is overseen by ubiquitous computing and AI and facial recognition and predictive analytics and drones and police robot dogs and crazy things like that. That it's almost gonna be like, you know, we're in Tron or something like that. And then the hedge funds will be placing their bets. So it sounds far-fetched, but I can lay out and, you know, feel free to chime in. But like some of the examples of these early pilot stage social impact bonds, sometimes the early phase was called social impact finance, social impact bonds, which were brought here from the United Kingdom. And then there were a small number of pilots, but they were not scalable. And so the next phase is going to be something called pay for success finance, or like social impact partnerships type of language, but ultimately it's an outcomes-based government contract tied to data analytics. That's a lot.
Yeah, no, it's all super interesting to see, especially with the technological aspect of it, where we're well aware of that there's negative effects of technology, right? Where screen time's bad and kids are being desensitized and losing their social skills because of this technology. But when you tie it into the financial model and the hoarders of wealth kind of using it to play a game of wealth upcycling into their own systems, which they're using to create more advanced systems of of exactly what you just described. But it's easy to see the gamification for me is prominent, because there's already right now, there's like a lot of food delivery apps and stuff that sort of have like this augmented reality, gamified reality aspect to them, that like, oh, you're a DoorDash driver, and if you do this many deliveries in the next 37 minutes based on our data model algorithm, then you get a $5 bonus, or you're only getting, you know, $2.27 for this delivery, but if you complete two more, you'll get your bonus. And I can see.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And it's one of those things that, yeah, it's just for most people, a lot of people I know, like bike messengers and stuff, it's just a side job. So it is sort of just like fun, you know, and for them where it's, you know, they're making a little extra money on the side and they'll go for that bonus.
Well, eventually it's food credits, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And then like apply that concept to what you were saying about pathways and pay for success pathways of you don't have much autonomy on it. It's like, okay, you have the choice to go for that bonus on your caviar delivery or not, but when it's incentivizing your next meal or, you know, something, your rent or any, your electrical bill, whatever it is, it's easy to see how these things, it's just an app, but an app could be easily applied to a digital identity or what have you. So,
well, I mean, the other concept I didn't have a chance to talk about yet is the idea of augmented reality, because that's another piece of the gaming environment of like turning life into a game. And the early sort of rollout for that was the Pokemon Go, you know, the first sort of wide deployment of that. And I think most people are not familiar, like unless you're sort of in that space, that Niantic, which is the company that advanced that, the money for Niantic came from InQtel, which is the venture capital arm of the CIA. And so if you understand that this augmented reality is coming from within the state surveillance apparatus, that gaming quality, you know, it gives a different nature to that game, right? Of capturing things, you know, in your phone. And, you know, it speaks to the fact that I think a lot of times people are thinking like, this new world that's coming is a world that's layered with information, right? And so we already have that somewhat like in the real world. Like if you move to a new neighborhood, like someone who's grew up in that neighborhood will look at a building or, you know, they'll say, oh, that's that house, that store used to be a ice cream shop, right? Like they'll have a layer of information that you may or may not have. And so there is already a layer of augmented reality, like in terms of people's lived experience in the built environment, but then this is actually adding a digital overlay. So instead of just like there would be through GPS coordinates and, you know, linked to, you know, GIS and the satellite systems, like that ice cream, like if you had the right, you know, app or virtual reality glasses or whatever, you know, AR augmented reality glasses, you could say, oh, this is the health, you know, the sanitation rating of that ice cream shop. This is the taxes on that building. This is the last time it was renovated. This is, you know, like there are many, you know, here's the reviews of the people who went there of what kind of ice cream was the favorite ice cream. And like, so there would be all of these levels that you could dig into on that store, that information. But if you imagine the extent to which a lot of the data analytics in our environments is also incorrect, messed up, racialized, you know, it, and it creates feedback loops around this information. So it sort of doubles down on these realities that may and magnifies, you know, differences in ways that may not actually be authentic, but are contrived within these engineered environments. So, you know, if we're thinking about the world as a game, you could walk out your own front door, and we're seeing this in other countries under these lockdown protocols, the rise of QR codes, because the QR codes are an element of this augmented reality that you're supposed to check in, that there's information shared about you and your coordinates, and also you're getting information from these environments. And it's rather clunky, like ultimately it will be much more sophisticated, but it's in terms of normalizing that behavior, that you're interacting with a built environment in a way that is mediated through digital technology.
I mean, totally, we're already there because it, like people kind of scoff at the idea of augmented reality having an effect on their existence or being part of their overall existence. But the things that you just mentioned with the QR codes and stuff, like Google, which Apple and Android already have a collaborative, interactive platform for exposure notifications where it's like an Internet of Things kind of beta test rollout of your phone interacting with other people's phones via Bluetooth and potentially interacting maybe even with the Wi-Fi routers of different businesses and stuff, or identifying where you've been and tracking your location and telling you whether or not you've been exposed or not. And again, just the idea that an artificial intelligence algorithm based on sensor-driven networks is going to be able to accurately tell you that your body has been exposed to a virus is completely insane. But it's just, this is the world that we're living in. And the same thing with the QR codes that you mentioned. I don't know how many places were following through with this or were part of it, but I know that the contactless scan the menu at restaurants for outdoor dining in San Francisco and throughout the country, I guess, potentially were extracting your information and data to identify you. And again, for contact tracing purposes, would extract your data from your phone by scanning that QR code. And I mean, we only went to one place one time that was before we got seated, we had to give our names and phone numbers. And we were just like, me and my fiance were like, all right, well, we love this place, but I don't think we'll be going back anytime soon.
Exactly. Yeah, it's I mean, the other element of this, like the gamification piece, and this is something that, you know, I'm, because of the nature of where I am in Philadelphia, both we have this like a deep history, right? And I think I have a bit of a unusual take on some of my analysis around what is unfolding in terms of like resistance, because I know a lot of people are coming at this from more of like a constitutional rights, but as you know, the home of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, like I'm realizing that, you know, that is actually very flawed because the social compact with both, you know, enslaved people, Black people and Indigenous people was never fully extended. And so as we're moving into this new era in which physical labor and even knowledge work and care work is platformed, we're all disposable, right? Like we're all Gaza, we're all Lakota, you know, we're all of these dispossessed people who are in the way of this coming new mechanized economic construct that is very brutal. It's an amplification of that longstanding brutality. And so, you know, another element, I mentioned Wharton Business School, and one of the key figures that I've been very interested in, his name is Kevin Werbach. He's a professor at Wharton, and he has two specialties. And one is gamification, and then the other one is blockchain. So he has both of these pieces together. And he actually had a conference, it was about 2 or 3 years ago at Wharton, that was commemorating, I think, like an early FCC conference or thing like 10 or 20 years ago, like one of the first internet conferences, and that he was a part of. And it was called After the Digital Tornado. And I encourage people, if they have a chance, to look it up on the internet. They have a lot of talks that he brought, a lot of sort of different academics, and like Shoshana Zuboff of Harvard Business School, she's written Surveillance Capitalism, she was one of the presenters. And so there's some interesting talks. And in one of the talks, it was a panel discussion with Zuboff, actually, and there was a respondent at the end. And at the end of the talk, he was recounting being at an industry conference where they were actually talking about, within the next few decades, that people would have a chip that, where when they bought something in the grocery store, they would be able to sense hesitation. Like if you touched like a box of cereal and you looked at it and then you were gonna put it back, like they would know. And that they could actually dynamically price it to some sweet spot that would incentivize you to make that purchase. And they're like, they've already talked about this is coming. And you know, it's very interesting to me because my father, I grew up in sort of corporate suburbia, and he was, you know, like a working class guy who had done well, and he worked for Procter & Gamble his whole life. He sold Folgers coffee. So my dad was like the high school guy in the grocery store who made good, and then he went on to a corporate career with Procter & Gamble. But Procter & Gamble invented the Internet of Things. It was a gentleman who was doing inventory work with Oil of Olay. And so they sent him to MIT, and they created the Auto ID Lab for these RFID codes and ultimately scan chips that are coming. But so all of this is coming together to say, like, you've got dynamic pricing, you have Internet of Things sensor technologies. You know, in this scenario that they were talking about, they didn't actually add in like a sesame. I mean, maybe you could infer there was a sesame credit scoring, like that was a factor into your dynamic pricing. But if we understand that pay for success finance is based on measurable behavior change, especially around things like wellness, they will start to engineer individuals in terms of what their food choices are, especially if they are on some sort of public assistance that lives in a digital wallet. And then that's what's coming.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned about that concept of in the grocery store and behavioral change dynamics, I think Amazon is a perfect digital representation of that. And my dad, who's kind of started out, you know, working class, got a job at a bank, and then went on to work for PayPal and JP Morgan up until recently. He talks about Amazon, and he remembers back in its early days, it was all about the attention, the customer attention per product. And their predictive analytics were built around trying to predict what you were going to buy, what else you would buy based on what you were looking at, and how to present that. So I think that they've sort of mastered that. And once they pair that into a physical realm, all the technology and the systems are sort of already in place. It's just a matter of leveraging it into our lives and kind of making us deal with it at this point.
I mean, it's intense. I mean, the other thing, so, you know, I mentioned Kevin Werbach, and he had gamification. So he hosted this conference in blockchain. And, you know, there's a talk that you can see online. I think it's sort of like a continuing education for like Wharton alums, and it's about gamification and leaderboards that you were talking about, and sort of game mechanics. You know, and a lot of this game theory also is used in hedge fund predictions. So there's a very direct correlation between the hedge fund algorithms and making these bets and the game theory. But like towards the end of this talk that he was giving, he said, you know, sort of alluded to the fact that like sometimes people don't even know there's a game in play. Like they don't even know there is a game, right? And he's like, you want to be the game designer. Like you want to be the one to make the rules. Like if you're positioning individuals at Wharton, you know, who are the ones who will be the deciders in this new society, that that the choice position is to actually preferably be in a position that people don't even know there's a game in play, and then also that they can make the rules of the game up. That is the position of power. And I think that is what I'm struggling with right now to continue to articulate to people, is that even though it is not super visible beyond these QR codes or these phones, oftentimes these sensors are embedded in things like, you know, the bike shares, right? Those bike share bikes, they're Internet of Things bikes. Like you don't know I don't know exactly where on the bike the sensor is, but that is a data analytics collecting machine, right? Like your phone is the data analytics collecting machine. You know, these different, you know, the menus with the QR codes are data analytics collecting machines. There's all of these different intermediate, like data aggregators, and that once they can enforce us to have these digital biometric identities, which will, my presumption will be linked to these biometric health passports that is coming with the Commons Project and the Common Pass, they will start to have very robust options for interoperable data analytics that they will sell to us as privacy. But my concern is that people on public assistance who are being set up as impact commodities, the MIT has a software program called Enigma that actually can query on encrypted data. So you may actually still have data privacy, you individually, but it will not stop the world from being colonized by virtual sensors. You know, well, like you can have privacy in a world that is run by AI, where your children are taught on screens and your elderly parents are watched on an iPad, and you have what, like, I don't know, some self-medicated nano pill technology, you know, to manage your health. But you're going to be stuck with that. Like you can have your data be private with that, but it's none of having your data private is going to stop, you know, having not being able to like go pick apples at a farm or something like that. Like they don't want you to do that anymore. Man, because there's way more profit and data collection management if you have to sit on your couch and have the apples delivered to you.
Yeah, I grew up picking apples on farms in New Hampshire, so that one hits home for me. And I didn't even think about, I don't know how it just kind of slips past, and that's the nature of this thing. But yeah, those, I always make fun of the e-bikes, the bike share programs, because they're so stupid looking. But and all the techies like to ride them. But of course, it's an Internet of Things sensor network. And
they're going to know what your pulse rate is. They're going to know if you went up the hill.
Exactly. And your phone has the app on it. So the app is pulling data, your cookies from your phone. There's your data aggregation. And then
stop at the cafe on the way home. Did you get a beer? You know, like it's all. And it's intense because like I've been really like, to me, like I felt almost claustrophobic the last 6 months, just having like, you know, like I said, I came at this very gradually. I came at it through first the education piece, and then the poverty management piece, and then understanding the housing piece and the gentrification piece, and, you know, the behavioral health and the healthcare. Like it was just, it kept rolling. But the thing that I think has hit me the most in the past month is that on these impact pathways, that it's not simply about changing your behavior, although that is a big piece of it. And I will say in the gamification space that it's a lot of it is connected to the video game industry. And this is what I think a lot of folks on the left are not getting, the people who like have a traditional Marxist analysis. They're like, look, the system is falling apart. And I'm like, no, it isn't. It's not actually falling apart. It's actually broken through into this next dimension, which is virtualization. The continuing growth of this global economy in a world that is not sustainable in terms of physical material possessions has to grow into a digital space. So you will have virtualized goods, you'll have virtualized consumption, you will be virtualized as a commodity, as a data commodity, and it will be a different type of commerce, but will be no less predatory. And there will still be physical material elements to it because there's the data centers and there's the energy and the water. And, you know, there are physical elements, but it's not this, it's, you know, I can fully see, you know, in a few years, you're going to be like, you're going to have four outfits. You're gonna have four real outfits, right? Like you might have 200 outfits for your avatar, but you're only gonna have like four outfits, you know, like this, like fast casual clothing, whatever. Like, no, that's gonna all be virtualized. And it's going to be consumed and purchased in virtual currency. And so they need for us to live as avatars, as digital twins in this virtual space. And that's what is being built. That is what's going to be coded. You know, I don't have a good sense of the time frame. Like it may be like a generation to get that all fully coded into place until we are totally virtualized. But the government of Japan, their Agency of Science and Technology, has a paper that they're saying by 2050, we will be removed from having a physical mind and body in time and space.
That sounds like what SoftBank is trying to do too. That I think they're seeing.
Well, that's Japan, right? Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's Japan. So it's SoftBank. SoftBank is running the Saudi sovereign wealth fund money, and it's intense, right? And so part of it is like both conditioning people to live in these virtual spaces that we're in, but then there's another piece of actually, I think, engineering people's bodies through bioengineering and synthetic biology, which is a key element of the fourth industrial revolution. So normalizing population level bioengineering through nanotech and other biological processes, some of which are consumed in your food, some of which may be injected, some of which may be just inhaled in your environment or in your water systems. There's a conference going on now by the National Nanotechnology Institute, and I have not had a chance to spend much time with it, but I have several individuals that I know who are more closely attuned to the nanotech, and they sent me some images, and it's just shocking. it's straight up precision agriculture, nanotech and water purification. And you know, most of the scientists agree that there are like totally different laws of physics at that level, like at the nano level, the laws of physics don't apply in the same way. And so we're proceeding with this apace. Meanwhile, like I would say 99.95% of the world has no idea what's coming. And they're just pursuing it as though they have full consent of the whole global population to do all of this. And it's like, I feel like I'm living in a world run by mad scientists and nobody's holding them accountable.
It is mad scientists. And I think your statement about people not knowing what's coming, I don't even think they know what's coming, because like you talk about the nanotech level or the nano level of existence, it's basically a different dimension, just like the internet and the digital realm is basically a different dimension. There's something else to it. There's more to it that we don't understand. And that's why, I mean, I maybe save this for the end, towards the end of the conversation, but you know, artificial intelligence seems to be almost like it's sentient, coming, building itself into our realm. But
I feel sometimes like it's, I mean, people, I don't know. I remember like I had some, you know, I've lost a lot of like, I don't know. Maybe loss is a strong word, but like I've grown away from, which is not to say that things can't be restored, but individuals over the past 8 months who just couldn't know the things I know, you know, and it's, I don't want to know these things. I didn't actually want to know these things, but like, once you start to know, you're like, oh my gosh, I can't not know that. And then it leads to the next thing. And
yeah, it's definitely,
and, you know, they just said, you know, this could never be that coordinated. Even my husband, this can never be that coordinated. There's not like, it's too big. It's too complex. And on the one hand, I'm like, no, they go to Davos, they plan it out. These companies have 30, 50 year plans. Unilever has a 50 year plan. Procter & Gamble IBM has a 50 year plan. Like, does it have variations? Sure. But they know where they're driving things to. And, you know, I keep thinking the people who are at the top who actually know these plans, do they think that they're going to get a pass and that they're not going to have to be cyborgs? You know, I don't know. Like, do they think they've already got their island? Like, clearly the multi-billionaires have their islands and their wilderness preserves to live on. But like, you know, the people who are pulling down just a million a year, do they think they're going to get a pass? Like, I'm trying to figure out what the cutoff is, because like, you know, I had a big, I gave a presentation to someone in Tel Aviv, and you know, a lot of this is being driven by Israel, because it's Israel's the startup nation. It has been for the last 20 years. Like, it rivals Silicon Valley in terms of the level of sophistication. And a lot of it's coming out of the fact that they have, you know, compulsory military service. And so they get the creme de la creme of the math and science, you know, expertise, and then feed them into these startups, many of which are biotech. And I'm like, listen, like, you could be sitting in Tel Aviv, but you're building a thing that's going to eat your grandchildren. Like, if you don't watch out, because like your grandkids are going to be the investable portfolio product for the hedge funds in, you know, whether they're in New York, whether it's the Vatican Bank, whether it's the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, like someone's going to be buying your grandkids if we don't stop this thing that you're building, which seems really great right now because it's driving your economy in a nice way. But ultimately we're going to reach an end game. And so to me, I guess I wonder, like, there is the coordination at Davos. Surely there are these plans being made, but it almost at this point seems like maybe they're right. Like maybe it is verging into sort of a larger digital intelligence, it's, you know, that's emergent.
It's like a hive mind, because like Israel, Talpiot program, Unit 8200, those three statements alone, you would have connections to almost everything we've talked about and beyond. And a huge part of this whole thing is, you know, driven from Israel and the Talpiot program. But the national
like 8200 unit has its, the signals intelligence unit has its own social impact accelerator.
Exactly.
Which is something like, I mean, so, and it's a, the logic of how their economy is set up. It's set up with this, the military service, they get the skills expertise, and then, you know, it advances into these startups and the accelerators, and the accelerators like, okay, we have all this tech, what do we do with it? Well, I guess we better like create some cyborgs so we can run our biotech through it. I mean, that's the logic of this crazy thing, but no one stops to go like, oh, wait a minute, if we build this thing, that means we all have to be cyborgs next. Like nobody's thinking about that.
Yeah, it's like, it's very coordinated, but then there's almost not like, it's so coordinated and so pieced together, like universally, that there's no oversight and there's nobody saying, making that question of like, what about my grandkids? What about me and my wife? You know, like, what are we going to do with our lives when everybody's incorporated into the system? But in terms of the coordination,
like, do we want our elderly parents watched by iPads?
Yeah.
Like, do we want our children taught by like reasoning mind avatar, AI feedback loop? To what end?
Like, I don't think anybody actually wants that. But to illustrate a little bit of some of the overlay and how all these sort of systems and people, like, I think the easy way out, like you mentioned, like the Marxist viewpoint, and in San Francisco, there's a lot of like anti-capitalist, Marxist, socialist, that sort of realm, who are happy to see the system destroy itself or whatever, quote unquote. But, and then I tell them, I'm like, I'm with you in the sense of that I don't, that this system needs to be replaced by something much better, but this system is not being replaced. It's burning out. It's the phoenix. It's rising from the ashes, you know? It's burning out so it can rise to the most, more powerful than it's ever been before. And for example, backtracking a little bit here, but working at a grocery store that I do, Instacart is the new tech startup that's been around for about 5 years. It was founded by a guy who was a major Qualcomm exec, who Qualcomm is basically 5G. Qualcomm Snapdragon is like the innovative 5G processor that will kind of define the Internet of Things. He was also an Amazon supply chain engineer, but he started Instacart, and since then Instacart's grown into about like a $20 billion company or something like that. And they deliver groceries. They deliver, apparently you can get stuff from the Disney store delivered too now.
And, oh, perfect.
and Best Buy too. So, you know, you got all your needs, your electronics, your fan, your
you can cultural fandom. You can consume and be consumed at the same time.
But I did a little bit of digging, and I think the one of the heaviest funders for Instacart is Andreessen Horowitz. And so Andreessen Horowitz is heavily involved in blockchain and cryptocurrency. I think they invested in Ripple, the cryptocurrency. And they also are deep. They think they put like 80 million, if not 80 billion, I could be mistaken. What's the difference anymore? A large sum of money into Roblox, which is, I don't quite understand what it is, but it's a game. It's an immersive reality game, and it's super popular with like young kids.
I have a friend who, an online friend, but who's had a friend of a friend, I guess, but that their young child was being groomed. It's an immersive, participatory online space. I don't know if you construct the space and then you play in it together, like play.
There's probably a constructible element to it.
Yeah, like, but this was like an adult and a six-year-old child who was being like laid out on a bed.
That's not good.
It's crazy. And yeah, it's really intense because people are not like, I mean, that's already, I mean, beyond the child molestation aspect of it, it's also this transhumanist, like human competing interface that you are existing through an avatar persona. And the thing that I want to message is, especially like from people coming from like the left, like anti-capitalist frame, is that people need to understand that this is a militarized space. It may look fun. It may look like Pokemon Go. It may look like, you know, Roblox. It's a military architecture. You know, whatever like, you know, sparkles and glitter and decorations you want to put on it, it's a military infrastructure. It has to be understood as an imperial project, this thing that is rolling out.
Perfect segue.
And I don't think people are used to thinking about it like that.
Perfect segue from where I was going with that because, oh no, you're good. It's perfect. So Andreessen Horowitz, one of their most recent large investments, I think it was like October of 2020, they put a large sum of money into this military technology company called Anduril, A-N-D-U-R-I-L. And it's a Peter Thiel collaborative project with the guy who started Oculus, the virtual reality system. Separate issue, but the guy who started Oculus is like this 25-year-old kid, Trump supporting weird, like it seems like a front to me, but anyways, they funded this company, and the main component of Anduril's services is something they call the Lattice network, which is like an AI infrastructural overlay network that's like Internet of Things, sensor, like the whole nine yards. And wouldn't you know it, that guess who Anduril's number one customer is? The United States Customs and Border Protection.
Right. Yeah, so, no, I mean, it is. It's.
You can see how. Yeah, okay.
They're building an open air global digital prison, I mean, is what is happening. Is that, you know, and I will say I'm so frustrated because, you know, I was organizing with folks locally, you know, 3 years or so ago around the Occupy ICE movement here in Philadelphia. And, you know, all of the Democrats were pointing fingers, you know, about the detainment camps, which are terrible. But in Pennsylvania, we have a Democratic governor and we have one of the four family detention centers for immigration in Pennsylvania. So there are not many, there's like four of them. And one of them is here in Berks County, Pennsylvania. And our Democratic governor would never close it. Like he had it within his limits of like licensing and processing, like to shut it down. And he never would. And I was at events, like I showed up at an event like, the Center for American Progress was some event about immigration. And I was like, wait a minute, this isn't actually just a Trump thing. Like, surely it is that, but it's also who is doing this in our state? Oh, it's our Democratic governor. Well, why after, and it's still going on, he still hasn't shut it down, Governor Tom Wolf. Well, it's because we're all supposed to get used to being families in digital incarceration. I mean, this wasn't digital incarceration, this is physical incarceration, but the Democrats and liberals are just as much about the carceral state, the carceral control state, and it will be morphing, and it will be morphing into something that is not the same nature of incarceration that we're used to imagining, which is why they're fine to like start letting people out, which is, again, I'm not saying people should be incarcerated. It's clearly part of managing the global labor force, but what's coming next is not going to be any better.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like I think the pacifist or like the person who says like it can't be this coordinated, like this isn't going to happen the way you say it is, can kind of play off of the fact that it's so separated and disjointed in terms of the money going so many different places, like Andreessen Horowitz investing in blockchain, investing in gaming, investing in military technology. Like, oh, okay, they're just trying to turn a profit. And it's like, no, yes, they are driving massive profit, but there's an infrastructure being laid out here between all these things. And
they, most people haven't conceptualized it that way. It's an open air global digital prison run from space, and it's a game. It's a brutal, devious game. And in the video gaming industry and the entertainment industry, like, that is why California is so messed up. Like, literally, until I started like doing this work, I don't know. Like, there's sort of this, I don't know, those of us who don't live in California, like, we have an idea of what we think California is, but I'm like, it's way military. It's way deep state. It's way police state. It's not like this progressive thing that people, I used to think. Like, the more I got into it, I'm like, there's a very dark undercurrent to California.
There's a very dark undercurrent in California, and it's flowing straight through San Francisco into Los Angeles especially. But San Francisco is like ground zero for political criminality and political overlay into this system. Like, I mean, the Newsom, Pelosi, the overlaying with the Pritzker family, and yeah. Again, calling them politicians and stuff is sort of a misnomer, because yeah, they have these titles, but really they're serving these other interests and their own interests for that matter. But it's almost like the politics side of it is like a side job with like a little bit of benefits for them that makes things a little easier. But at the end of the day, it's like, I mean, the homeless problem in San Francisco is crazy, and they just funnel hundreds of millions of dollars a year into oblivion. Like, they have homeless services, they have public works programs, and all they do is wash the streets with what I call it piss water, because they just use this like non-potable water or whatever, and they just spray the streets even when it's raining. And like, that's, I feel like that's the 100 million right there.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess that's why I'm so flummoxed at like all of what's happening under all of this lockdown situation, that people can't see it, that people who ostensibly say that they care about these issues cannot actually see what's happening.
Where's the liberation movement? Where's like the people's liberation, you know, around this idea?
Like, where's the anti-globalization? I mean, because this new world, it is a globalization, but it's globalized fascism. I mean, and
it's like all these companies too, all these corporations that are cycling wealth between each other and through like NGOs and stuff. I kind of get the feeling that it's almost like their technology and such, and also the fact that like Amazon and Microsoft have government contracts with like cloud data and stuff, and that's sort of like politics 101 is blackmail, right? So if you're handling somebody's cloud data, then you have you're a gun to the back of their head, and you're kind of walking them through things. And at the end of the day, it seems like a lot of this technology and all these corporations almost have subverted government, maybe by design. Maybe the government's kind of given them the keys to the back door.
We actually have a government anymore.
Exactly. I agree completely.
There is no government anymore. Like, we're commodities for their consumption, really. I mean, early on, the work I was doing around education and pay for success finance. So Santa Clara, California is like, and San Jose are test beds for a lot of these innovative finance deals. And so really for the past 5 to 8 years, they've been trying out different aspects. And so, as I mentioned, this concept of social impact bonds came from the United Kingdom. It was advanced by this gentleman. His name is Sir Ronald Cohen, who's the father of British venture capital, and he's a Harvard MBA. So Michael Bloomberg brought them over. Like Goldman Sachs was backing a lot of these impact bonds, and it was based off of cost negative externalities. So it was almost like carbon credit trading, which was set up by William Drayton with Ashoka, which I believe is also California based. This idea of like a carbon credit, like offset financialized sort of abstracted idea. But the offsets would be something like reincarceration, like the cost of reincarceration, the cost of special education, the cost of addiction treatment. And they would all have these numbers. And so that if you could provide a solution that mitigated that cost, you could negotiate like a rate of return. So really for the past 8 years, they've been trying out all different kinds of social impact bonds around housing, around pre-K, around mental health services. And at least four of them were in Santa Clara County, and they were triggered by Santa Clara University. So a lot of these programs are actually running through the Jesuit colleges. So Georgetown is a major player, and Santa Clara and Gonzaga, and I'm trying to think of the one in Chicago, is it DePaul? There's a very strong Catholic element, because the stuff that's coming is not just, I call it like techno-fascism, but it's theological techno-fascism. It won't just be the Catholic Church, but it'll be major faith institutions. And I think ultimately the goal is actually to blockchain religion so that you will be shunted into, because most of these major, you know, are you part of, you know, is it the Vatican? Is it LDS? Is it the mega churches? You know, which bit, because they're the ones doing the social services, and they'll be providing, you know, the housing, right? Like, you know, and like, God forbid you end up like in a faith-based housing community that goes against whatever your principles are, and you're on blockchain for some like faith that isn't your faith. But anyway, so this is coming in Santa Clara. So they have a pre-K one called Strong Start. They have an early literacy one. They have a homeless one called Welcome Home, and Project Welcome Home, and Partners in Wellness, like a mental health one. So the homeless social impact bond and the mental health social impact bond, in these deals, to make them appear legitimate, they have a third party that will review the contract to say, oh, this service provider fulfilled the terms of the contract according to the data. And the third party for both of those in that case was Palantir. So again, so now you have housing insecure people, and they're being put into social services to get shelter, but Palantir is running their data, right? You know, Peter Thiel's company, Predictive Policing, and Department of Homeland Security, as well as, you know, Palantir has the data of people who are getting mental health treatment. And it's very unethical. I mean, it's an unethical program, but I don't, you know, it's difficult, because I think, like, and clearly we had talked before about Salesforce and Mark Benioff being, you know, a key element in this. A lot of these deals are run on data analytics dashboards. So both Microsoft and Salesforce have sort of competing versions of social welfare service impact dashboards. So that's like the running the global prison, the running the global prison game runs on these dashboards, and both Salesforce and Microsoft are competing. But if you're talking about these biometric health passports, right? Like, if essentially you're running the gauntlet of a prison state, and you have some sort of in real time implanted biosensors, you know, that are like monitoring your temperature or your heart rate to tell you if you're a threat, you pose some viral threat to the world. Your ability to navigate an augmented reality space could mean that, based on your, you know, biosensor that you have embedded in your body, that you can't go outside. You can't leave your apartment. You can't get off the elevator. Oh, well, you can only go this far. You know, you can only go 5 miles from your house. Your Easy Pass is deactivated. You can't get that Internet of Things bike. Like, there are these very real consequences. And so, like, I know a lot of folks in the immigration community were approaching Salesforce because they had these contracts with Department of Homeland Security. But what I'm trying to say is, for people who are working in spaces of like immigration, the idea of using geofencing and real-time borders is changing what a border is.
Exactly. Like
changing what a border is. A border could be your house. It could be, God forbid, your bedroom. You're in a senior care center and you can't open the door. That could be the border.
Exactly. Like the military technology, the Lattice Network AI system. Yeah, they're using it on the US-Mexico border, which is already problematic enough as it is, right? But how much would it take to just apply that to the city of San Francisco or whatever, or anywhere, everywhere, yeah, for that matter, as long as you have the infrastructure, and the infrastructure is being built. So Salesforce,
and nobody's contesting it. Like, all of the people who seem to, like, that's what's so frustrating, is that the people who are contesting this, the limitations that are being imposed, like the abrogations of civil liberty, are not the people for whom these social justice issues are front and center, right? And the people for whom the social justice issues are front and center are the ones who are saying, everybody just behave and it'll go away. And it's like the most bizarre thing to be in the middle of this and go, none of this is making sense.
Yeah.
Other than that, they've so totally, like, the social media landscape has so totally, like, fragmented people's consciousness that they've become so embedded in their own identity politics feedback loops that they can't see the forest for the trees. They just can't.
Yeah, everybody hates on mainstream media these days for it becoming a caricature of itself, but you could pretty much say the same thing for the alternative media or the quote-unquote alternative media, because it's all it's the same thing. It's a feedback loop. It's an echo chamber, and it always gets more absurd and further away from the truth or where it actually needs to go. Or that's what I see. You know, there's so many big personalities who are seemingly, you know, truth seekers and powerful personalities in this whole thing, but they touch on the information that you get into, but they don't actually make the connection, or they choose to ignore the connection, and they don't, you know, bring it back around to what's really going on. It's kind of just meant to add fuel to the fire of the political discourse. And that's really frustrating.
People are taking it to the point of talking about the privatization of every aspect of the public domain, every social welfare service, right? No one is really talking about that part. So we're going to privatize all of your healthcare. We're going to privatize all of your education. We're going to privatize all of your housing. Everything is just up for investments, up for the predictive analytics. And it's frustrating because, like, there are pieces that if you gave people the tools and you said, look for pay for success, Google your community and put in quotes, pay for success, right? And see what comes up. See what comes up under value-based payment in Medicare. See what comes up in gamification or augmented reality in your community. See what comes up with the Internet of Things in your community. Like, things that people could actually make it concrete. It's not conspiracy, because you can see what is this, what works government. Michael Bloomberg has bought off hundreds of governments of many mid-sized cities across the country and in the EU and in India to administer this data-driven prototype. There are things that people could look at and go, oh, you know, they were talking about that. Look here it's in my city. What does this look like? And no one's getting those tools yet. And I think they should, they need them.
And I know it seems like a lot to a lot of people, this is like sort of like heavy, intense information, but once you familiarize yourself with some of the most like prominent terminologies that are used in this thing, if you take a little bit of a look, you find it like right away. Yeah. Even today I was looking into the massive human resources cloud-based computing network that my work is using to run its HR and employee like clock in, clock out, and healthcare information through. They have white papers all about human capital. They have white papers all about augmented future. They have, it's like, it just keeps popping up over and over again. And you mentioned Salesforce designing the digital health data pass dashboards for this future we're discussing. And I think Salesforce is a really prominent topic because, I mean, even people who don't get into all the details that we're talking about in San Francisco and the Bay Area, like the Salesforce Tower is universally hated as a symbol of cultural warfare and gentrification. And people don't really need to go much further than that to understand, you know, how much evil and negative energy is emanating off of that structure and the whole program. But I mean, Mark Benioff is the founding co-chair of the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution in San Francisco, which ironically is located in the Presidio close by to where DARPA first laid out the internet and where DARPA probably was running the pilot program for Facebook before it was passed off to Zuckerberg. But I know that Salesforce is partnered with the SoftBank Vision Fund, which the SoftBank Vision Fund is directly overlaid with the 2030 vision by the World Economic Forum. So that it's like this crazy.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about the UN stuff yet.
Yeah, exactly. You said like this is all the private corporate stuff, but then it just directly overlays and interlocks into the governmental United Nations, all these policies and these programs, and then the philanthropists all kind of come in and circle around, smell blood in the water, and you know, they all come running. All right, so that'll conclude the first installment of my talk with Allison McDowell of wrenchinthegears.com. I think that is a really good introduction and a good overview of the world of human capital finance, impact investment, and how emerging financial technology and predictive data analytics are fueling the creation of something that the world has never seen before. And that's kind of the point. It's commodifying everything on Earth, including human biological activity and biometric data. But one of the most important things that I think Allison brought up that we should all kind of just focus on right now, because it's becoming more real by the day and it's very tangible, is the Commons Network and the Common Pass app that she mentioned, brought to you by the World Economic Forum, Apple, Android, Google, and the Cornell Technion Complex that we mentioned earlier. But the idea behind Common Pass is that it is a digital identity, digital health passport app. So it stores your medical records, it has your vaccination status, it has your PCR test status, basically, you know, all your biometric information data stored into this application. And one of the things about it is it was kind of rolled out in summer of 2020, early summer, I want to say, where there was like a universal media blitz around the subject. They all sort of rolled out headlines about, if you want to see live music in 2021, this is something you might need. And it was like the World Economic Forum's basically press release of saying, we're working with Ticketmaster, and if you want to go see concerts, all these shows we've put on for all these years, you're going to need this digital health passport app on your phone, and you're going to need proof of a negative test and or proof of vaccination. And that's all stored into the data on the app. And there's definitely a blockchain angle of this too. This will probably be a blockchain-driven data network at some point, but I don't think that that's on the forefront of how they're advertising it just yet. But at the end of 2020, I want to say 2 days before Christmas, they also did a secondary media rollout of the Common Pass network, Common Pass app. And this time, instead of it talking about if you want to see music, this time it was if you want to travel in 2021. This is something that you're probably going to have to be using, the Common Pass, brought to you by World Economic Forum. And it went on to detail to say, there's these airport networks, there's these airlines, all these other travel institutions that are beta testing and singing the praises of the Common Pass. So, you know, this is something that if we let this in the door, then our society will rapidly transform. We are being rapidly prepared for this new financial structure. And once it, the thing about this technology, and we mentioned the oversight of it all, there is no oversight and there is no direct end game. It's always going to amplify. It's always going to create systems that only encourage it to grow and permeate into our lives. So I just want everybody to kind of think long and hard about where we are at as a species and what this Common Pass app represents to all of us, and how things will never be the same once this is implemented. Even just look at the Common Pass website. On the very first thing you'll see is Common Pass. Share your current health status so you can safely return to travel and life. Soon to be available in the Apple Store and Google Play Store. So, travel and life, you're going to need this technology, this app, to return to life. I don't know about you, but that sounds a lot like extortion to me. So this is very problematic. I know it's a lot. I know that this is heavy information, but we're all humans, and sharing this is an honor and a privilege, and I'm happy that you're here listening to me. I hope you tune in for part two. Allison and I kind of get into a little bit more of a personal perspective, share some spiritual, esoteric elements to this whole agenda, and kind of circle back around some things. So part two coming soon. Thanks for tuning in. Utopia is a scam. Until next time.